Good morning, everybody. Welcome to our shiur. This week's parsha we read yesterday, Parsha Shemini, goes through some of the basic laws of kashrus. Speaks about the signs of the kosher species, animals, birds, fish, and as such, I figured it was a good opportunity to speak about a topic in kashrus, which is very, very relevant in our times, becoming probably one of the biggest issues in halacha in our time, and that is the question of leaving a non-Jewish housekeeper in a kosher home, especially leaving such a person alone. This is something which years ago was not relevant among people because of the fact that very often, it was very rare years ago that women worked. That has changed. Due to the relatively affluent society that we live in, it's more common that people look for help, even people who stay home look for help. And therefore, a lot of things have changed in our times, and there's been certain technological changes that also affect halacha in terms of having a non-Jewish woman in the house, which we will see. So therefore, I think it's very important to go through. This is something that's relevant to most people, and there are certain surprising halachas here that it's very important to know. I would say in advance that a great deal of information came from the Sefer, the Kosher Kitchen, by Rabbi Benjamin Forrest of New York, and it's a very, very beautiful sefer that's published by Art Scrolls in English, very, very valuable. Anyway, what are the issues? We'll start from the beginning. What are the issues involved with having a non-Jewish person in the home? What issues could there be? So, list off five issues that could come up. There are really more than that, but there are five that I would like to address strictly from a kashrus standpoint. And they are not in any particular order. Number one, food left with a non-Jew. Person, husband and wife go off to work in the morning and they come back later. The non-Jewish woman has been there. How do you know the food that is in your house is the same food that you left? So you'll say, well, it's all in the same wrappers. Okay, that's fine. If in fact it is all in the same wrapper. However, if you left meat in the freezer, it's not wrapped, or chicken, or something like that, cheese, how do you know that it wasn't switched? Mm-hmm. Now you'll say, isn't that ridiculous? So we'll see under what circumstances the person has to be concerned about that, but that would be the first question that would come up. How do you know that the food that is unlabeled is the same food that you left in the morning? Number one. Number two, even assuming that the food is the same, how do you know that your utensils, your kosher utensils, have not been tampered with? It's possible that this housekeeper went ahead and cooked something. And we'll see that it depends if she knows your schedule, but let's just assume in the worst case scenario that she knows that both the husband and the wife have full-time jobs and there's no chance that they're going to pop in the middle of the day. So then how do you know that she didn't cook herself food in your utensils that in a non-kosher way? It could be that she brought food with her that's not kosher, or it could be that she took your kosher food but cooked it in a non-kosher way. She may have taken dairy products and cooked them in a meat pot or vice versa. How do you know that that didn't happen? Okay, a third topic that comes up related to this would be the washing of dishes. Part of her responsibility is to wash the dishes, so there could be obviously a problem there in the halacha if she's washing together the milk and the meat dishes. So you have to be concerned, perhaps you have to be concerned that something went wrong there. Number four, if in a situation where the non-Jewish woman is given the responsibility to do some cooking, so there are issues of dishalakum. There are issues that we know that food cannot be eaten. Generally speaking, the food cannot be eaten if it was cooked by a non-Jew, even if all the ingredients are kosher. Right? The law of dishalakum has nothing to do with the concern that the food is not kosher. Even if you know for sure that every single ingredient was kosher, oftentimes if something is cooked by a non-Jew, that would render it inedible, halakhically. And finally, we have the issue of wine. That we know that there's a concern, we spoke about this once, about stam yenam, that wine that is tampered with by a non-Jew could be considered halachically unusable past a certain point. So these are all concerns that come up just strictly in the field of kashrus. There are other concerns that also it could be a question. Questions come up of yichud, right? If a man is along with a housekeeper, so that would be a question of yichud because the law of yichud applies to not being isolated. A man and a woman who's not his wife not being isolated applies even to non-Jews. So therefore, you could have a situation of that. There are other things that come up, but I'd like to stick strictly to these points and to see what the issues are and what could be done. Now, whenever you broach this topic with people, so the first thing people will say very often will be that, well, I don't have anything to worry about because the woman who works in my house has been with us for so many years and she's so erelof, she's so honest, she's like a member of the family, we trust her, I would leave my jewelry with her, we leave money out all the time, and she never takes anything, she's 100% trustworthy. Okay, that is the common line that is said to avert these concerns. Now, this happens to be a mistake. This explanation or excuse, whatever a person wants to say, was not really valid. And the reason for that is because it's not simply a question of trust. Because of the fact that to non-Jews, the halachas of basar v'chalav, the laws of kashrus, are absurd. They have no relevance to them, right? And it doesn't make any sense. So even if they're loyal, but the fact of the matter is that when it comes down to it, so it's true that because this woman is a good person and she's very trustworthy, you don't have to suspect that she will maliciously attempt to do anything wrong. That's fine. But what happens if we all know, in a daily job, if a person, sometimes you have a bad day, sometimes you make a mistake, sometimes you have something on your mind and you're not concentrating and something could go wrong. Well, if that goes wrong, or let's say she's looking, you told her, okay, you have to wash the dairy dishes with the dairy sponge. Now, let's say she can't find the dairy sponge because it wasn't left in the right place by accident. So who is to say she has to get the job done? There's a whole stack of dishes. Who is to say that under the duress of the moment, she's not going to say, they're not home anyway. What difference it makes? It's all nonsense. And I saw in this sefer that I was referring to, he made the analogy, which is not so far-fetched. He said imagine if one of us worked in the house of a person who had these bizarre beliefs, a person who believed in voodoo, or something like that. And you say, well, they have all these rules and stuff. But when it came down to it, we might be tempted to say in certain situations, the whole thing's ridiculous anyway. So what difference does it make? What they don't know can't hurt them. That's really where the issue lies. It's not a question of this woman is dishonest. It's a question of she doesn't care about the halacha and also the consequence of making a mistake, right? It happens in the best of circumstances. In any kosher home, sooner or later, at some point or other, a shiloh comes about because that's just the way it is. It happens. People make mistakes. Or sometimes, by accident something spilled into a place where it shouldn't have. So a person who's concerned with halacha would call a rabbi and say, all right, what do I do in this situation? But a non-Jewish woman, and if nobody's home and that happened, so why would she even feel necessary to report it? Why would she feel that necessary? She might just simply say, okay, what they don't know can't hurt them, and that's it. They don't know, I won't tell them, I don't want them to look poorly upon me, I don't want to lose my job. So therefore, what's the big deal anyway? All of this comes not from a lack of trust, not from dishonesty, but it comes from not taking halacha seriously. Which is totally understandable. Which is totally understandable. I remember a close friend of mine who worked in a hotel for Pesach years ago, just to digress for a moment, told me that the hotel had a very good hefsher and it was a non-kosher hotel during the year, but for Pesach, they had a very good program and they had a tight hashgacha in the kitchen and so forth. And the chef, the main chef, wore a chef's hat when he was cooking. And nobody thought anything strange about that. That's something that people do. But he noticed, over the days of Pesach, he noticed that it seemed that this chef must have had some sort of itch on his scalp because he kept, you know, quickly like shaking his hat. And he figured that being he's the Mashkiach, he should check a little more carefully. So he set himself up in a place where he was not seen, but he could see exactly what was going on. And he noticed that what was happening was the chef had his prize knife that he used to slice vegetables. He had it under his hat. It was not a kosher knife, but the knife that the hotel had given him, he was not comfortable with. Much in the same way that I would imagine a surgeon is most comfortable with his equipment, or a ball player, right? You go to a professional baseball player and say, don't use your glove, I'll give you this glove instead. But this is my glove. This is the glove that I use. So too, to this chef, these are his tools of trade. He's a top chef who's being paid a lot of money, and this is something that he feels comfortable with. So he was very quick, and he was able to go under the radar until he finally got caught by my friend. And this is what he was doing, that every time it came to slice something, he would quickly push back his hat, pull out the knife, and then put it back, and nobody was seeing it. So therefore, now you say to yourself, so what kind of, what is this person, a lowlife? Is this person, obviously he's violating the trust that they put in him, but if you would have asked him, he probably would have said, oh, that's all nonsense. It's all nonsense. What's the difference between the knife that they gave me and the knife that I use? Well, they both look the same. What's the difference? So the answer is, you'll say, yeah, but this knife was koshered and this and that and the other thing. He doesn't care what the Shach says. He doesn't care what the Shulchan Aruch says. Right? It doesn't mean anything to him. So therefore, that is the problem. This is something that people don't take into consideration. And that really overtakes the reality that I trust this person. It could very well be that the person is trustworthy. But the concern is that if something goes wrong, will they feel the responsibility to tell you about it? There's no concern that, okay, I'm using something which is trafe and now all my food is trafe. By them, it's just a question, okay, so it happened. You know, a lot of times, even Jewish people who aren't familiar with halacha will say, alright, one time is not such a big deal. You know, to recognize what constitutes a shaila even is not such a simple thing. So therefore, when you're dealing in this area, it's not simple to just say that I don't have to worry because this is a person who I could trust. And particularly if the person is concerned that they may lose their job, which we'll soon see that that's really something that they need to know, that if they violate the law, they're going to lose their job. So then that makes it, that compounds it. Now I'm really hesitant to say anything. Yes?
I know it's probably a problem, level of trust is not as important. A lot of times we're trusting these people to take care of our kids.
Right.
There's probably nothing else more important.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, we're trusting our kids.
Right, I'm saying.
You know?
Okay, I think some people would. Right, okay, so that's also, that might also be questionable if you're trusting your kids with them. But the difference is that trusting a baby with a babysitter, the concerns are universal. In other words, Goyim have the same concerns that Jews have as far as the safety of the child. They may not, you know, as a child grows older, you know, then there could be other issues. It's true that there could be issues with a babysitter for an old mate. Expose the child to things that you're not comfortable with. You know, they may bring in something to the house, or may bring in, you know, an iPod or an iPhone with the things on it and show the kids the pictures and stuff. So, but with a baby, it's the same. You're right. I mean, so that just means that you should be concerned about that too. But with a baby, the concerns are universal. It has nothing to do with halacha. But when you're dealing with the laws of Basar V'Cholov and the laws of Kashrus, which only makes sense to Jews. They have no relevance, and you can't blame a non-Jew for not taking it seriously. If we were in their shoes, in the same, if the tables were turned, and you went into a guy's house who had these beliefs and these rules, you would say to yourself, okay, listen, you know, it's good for them, but if it comes down to it, if I have to get a job done and I can't find the thing that they want me to use, and it doesn't mean anything to me to use the other one, why wouldn't I do it? So that's where the areas of how the issues come up. That's where a person, it's just important to have that mindset to understand that trust alone does not solve this problem. Okay, so now, addressing the issues. Now, First, we'll speak about food that's left with a non-Jew. That was the first issue. How do you know the food wasn't switched? And we have to be concerned about that. So we find here in the Gemara, in Chulin tells us, it's here on the sheet, the Gemara in Chulin on Daf Tzadi Heim and Aleph says on the top of the page, on the top of the sheet, Omer Rav, Basar Kivan Shinesala Min Ha'ayin Basar. The Gemara says that meat, once it has left the eye of a Jew, meaning once you lost sight of it, you lost track of it, is forbidden to be eaten. Okay, that means that this is a din d'rabbanan. This is a law that the rabbis enacted. That meat that you lost track of is forbidden to be eaten. Why is it forbidden to be eaten? Forbidden. So if you look here in Rashi, so Rashi says on the top of the Rashi column on the right, okay, he says, what does it mean? The Salim in Ha'ayin Shehayasha Achas Shelo Ra'ol, that there was a moment, or meaning not just a second, but you know, a period of time that the person did not see it. Even if it was lying on his table. In other words, we're not just talking about food that was left out in the street, but even if a person had food on his own table, but he lost meat we're talking about, but he lost track of it, meaning that he went away from it, so it is usher to eat. Why? Says Rashi, Shema Nischalef Nevela. Because perhaps it was switched for non-kosher meat. Now you'll say, that sounds ridiculous, how could that possibly happen? So the truth is, if one looks into the sugya, some of the concerns, if one looks into the discussion of the Gemara, some of the concerns are outdated in our time. And for example, the concern that perhaps a bird came and switched, or some animal came into the house and switched the meat. But you'll say that's impossible to happen in our time. So okay, fine, that is true. That if a person, generally speaking, if you have food in your own house and you leave the house and nobody's home, you don't have to worry when you come home that the food was switched. Because how could it have been switched? The door was locked, nobody came in, so what could have happened? So therefore, generally speaking, if you leave meat in your house unattended, as long as nobody, if it's in fact unattended, nobody's there, so then there's nothing to worry about. Even if you've taken off all the wrappers, and all the simonim that indicate that it's kosher meat, but it's impossible that it could have been switched. Okay, however, what happens if there was somebody there? There was somebody there who could have switched it, potentially. So then, the concern comes up that maybe it was switched. Now, the truth of the matter is that, again, if one looks into the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch on this point, this concern only exists in a situation where there is something to be gained. In other words, you don't have to worry. This is a halacha that's brought in the Shulchan Aruch. In fact, you can see it, it's here on the sheet, in the section that's labeled Yeredeya, in Sif Yud, okay, towards the bottom, he says, I'll get back to the beginning of this a little bit later on, but he says that in Eino Nene Bechalipin Mutter Bechalinyin, that there is no concern of any shenanigans, of any switch taking place. We're talking now about switching kosher for non-kosher. There is no concern whether it is by the food or whether it is by kalim, unless there is something to benefit. If the guy has nothing to gain, so why would you switch it? What value is it to you to switch? So then he says the Shulchan Aruch, the lo chayshinon shemahichlif lahachshila. Because we do not halakhically have to be concerned that maybe a guy switched it simply for the reason to cause a Jew to violate the halacha. In other words, the old fear that you have this, you know, big anti-Semite who's hiding, you know, who presents themselves as some sincere woman, but really she's a devout Christian, and when you're not home, she goes around, you know, trafing up everything that you have and switching all your meat. Right? In the halacha, you don't have to worry about that. That's not a concern because it's considered very far-fetched. Why would they do that? You know, some religious fanatic. So even if you have one time heard a horror story where that happened, that doesn't mean that you have to worry about it. That's considered unusual, deviant, and that's not a halacha concern. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says here. In other words, you don't have to worry that maybe it was a malicious switch. Because what gain do they have from that? What gain? Do they have some religious satisfaction that they caused the Jew to go against halacha? It's very strange that that should be considered a gain because they don't see that. The whole thing is bizarre. So that you don't have to worry about. However, if there is a benefit to be switched, in other words, if you have better meat than they have, so then there might be such a concern. Now the truth is, from what I saw, and I think this may depend on who you ask, but from what I saw, generally speaking, kosher meat is not held to be, you know, the fact that the meat had shechita done to it, assuming it's both from a cow, and, you know, obviously cow's meat is better than horse's meat, but you can tell, from looking at it, you generally could tell what kind of meat it is. You know, if someone switches pork for the meat that you have in your freezer, you could probably see that just from looking at it. But in a situation, the concern that maybe they replace kosher meat with non-kosher meat, so why would they do that? Why is it better? You know, it's not really better just because it underwent shechita, melicha, hadacha. Why would that make it better? So that you don't have to worry about.
Unless it's a Chinese restaurant.
Yeah, right. Okay, so without getting into that. But okay, so the fact of the matter is, in a restaurant, that's a valid point. In a restaurant, it's different. The owner of a restaurant, obviously, this doesn't apply to, because on the buying end of it, it's a lot cheaper to buy the non-kosher meat. But if you have already kosher meat in your house, the concern that maybe some non-Jew came in here and switched it out for non-kosher meat, what gain would it be to them to do that? Yes.
It was a big scandal a couple of months ago. These fancy fish restaurants were supposed to be serving grouper.
Right.
And the grouper turned out to be catfish.
Catfish. All right, I'm saying in a restaurant, all bets are off. What I'm saying now does not apply in a restaurant or in any retail type of store because of the fact that when there's money involved, you know, as far as selling it, that's different. But in your own house, so this concern, generally speaking, a person would not have unless you have reason to believe that it's that they may have something to gain. So that a person has to make an assessment. Yes, sir. Some guys think that kosher meat is better. Okay, I don't know. The safer that I saw said that it doesn't seem so reasonable to say. I don't know. I would think that.
Who think
that it's higher quality? No, but higher quality to the extent that they go ahead and switch it. They think in general it's better.
It's healthier.
Okay, because they don't know. They don't know what kosher is. So therefore, they think that it's. In other words, if they knew the halacha that it was just a question of shechita and so consulted, they would say, "Why should this be any different?" But okay, maybe I don't know. Yeah.
My experience is actually exactly the opposite. I've been in many hotels at the end of Pesach where if a Tumchei Shabbos group or whatever doesn't come right away to get whatever's left over, the chef, whatever the program will leave over and give to the hotel, the chef will throw, I've seen chefs throw out hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pounds of meat in sealed boxes, and when you ask, what are you doing? He says, I don't care if it's free for me or not, it doesn't meet my standards. It's not the same as mine.
Like that. Okay. All right.
I see that. So
all right, go ahead, yes.
This in terms of what you're talking about before, about making errors.
Yes.
I used to drink coffee at people's offices.
Right.
I thought there was an issue with kashrut.
Yes.
Until one time in my own office,
right.
I had one of these Mr. Coffee machines, and I smelled the chicken cooking.
Right.
And my own secretary was making chicken broth
right. So I'm going to get to that right now. Okay. So that's a concern. Right. That could happen. Okay. A real life story. Okay. So now so even if we will say, so let's just say for a minute that you go to work in the morning and you're out of the house, so you don't have to worry that the meat was switched. You don't have to worry. In other words, obviously, if the meat is still in the packaging and it has the simonim, it has the signs, it can't be sold in stores, and then you clearly don't have to worry that it was switched. But even if you took it out, or it was cooked already, and you have some extras that you put in the freezer, or it was cooked in advance, whatever it may be, generally speaking, you don't have to worry about that. Okay, however, what a person does have to worry about would be the concern that maybe the non-Jewish woman cooked herself. that maybe she took your food and cooked it, but she didn't concern herself with the laws of kashrus, and therefore she took a piece of your meat and cooked it in a dairy pot, or vice versa, okay? That would be one concern. A second concern would be, well, if they brought in their own food, then maybe they heated up their own food in your oven. Right, similar to this situation with the coffee, right, where they brought in their own chicken soup or whatever it may be, and they availed themselves of the machine to use it. So the truth of the matter is, so this is a big concern in halacha. This is a very, very big concern in halacha that this could have been done. And how does one really know? How does one really know that it didn't happen? And again, it's just the fact that I trust them alone is not enough to remove the element of suffix, because it's true that you trust them, and the trust just means that they're not going to try to hurt you, but they don't appreciate that they're hurting you if it's something which doesn't make sense to them, and they figure that you don't even know about it. So what difference does it make? Right? There's no concept of the Yir Shamayim that it goes in involving a person who follows the laws of the Torah. It doesn't apply in their mind. It doesn't exist. So what? How do you get around these concerns? Okay, so I'm sorry. Yeah,
webcam.
Okay, that's true. That's one way to do it, right? So nowadays, you know, if you want to, you know, use the technology that's available today, some people do that they have some sort of camera, the same way they do it with babysitters. People are very concerned nowadays. All kinds of concerns with babysitters. So they put a camera in the kitchen. If you're going to do that, it would actually be halakhically better if you told them that you hide the camera, so then that's still not going to deter them because they don't know it's there. But if they know it's there and they know that you're watching, so okay. But that may be a little over the top for some people to do. You know, may feel that that's not such a simple thing. So if we look here in the Shulchan Aruch, the section that I was reading from before in Yerideya, it says as follows. It says that in Sif Yud, it says Hamineach Ovid Kochavim Beveso, that if a person leaves a non-Jew in their house, Ubo Dvarim She'im Huchlufu Yesh Bahem Afilu Issa Torah, and in the house there were items left behind that if they were tampered with would violate a Torah law, such as meat, things like that. So he says, the Shulchan Aruch says, "Im hu yotze v'nichnas." If the person who owns the home is yotze v'nichnas, yotze v'nichnas means he goes out and he comes in, meaning that he periodically enters, even if he's out of the house, but he periodically re-enters the house. Okay, so he says, then it would be good. Afilu shaz man rav, right? Even if he was away for an extended period of time. But here's the catch. V'lo hodio shedaito lishos. And he did not tell the non-Jew how long he's planning on being away for. In other words, this is the concept that people are familiar with, the hashgachas in restaurants or in kosher stores. So you have the mashgiach, so the expressions that we hear from time to time is they tell you have mashgiach tamidi, right? Mashgiach tamidi means that there's a mashgiach who's there constantly. He's always there. Doesn't leave. Right, but often that's not the case, and you have a mashgiach that's yotze v'nichnas. Yotze v'nichnas means not there all the time, but he arrives at unannounced times. In other words, he just periodically shows up. The reason why this helps is because that keeps the non-Jew on their toes, because I never know when he's going to show up. And since I know that if I violate the law and get caught, it could jeopardize my job. So therefore, I'm going to be uneasy. I'm not going to be comfortable violating it because you just never know when the guy's going to pop in. Right? So this is the concept in halacha that's called yotzei v'nichnas. So in hashgacha, you hear this term, but it's true in a person's house the same way. If a person leaves their home, but the non-Jewish housekeeper doesn't know your schedule, or even if you have a schedule, but sometimes you don't stick to it, so therefore they never develop that level of comfort that, oh, I know, now I can get away with it. There's no chance that anybody's going to come home for the next 2 hours. Right? If they have that level of comfort, then this does not apply. But if they don't have that, so then, even if you're not home, that's okay. Yep, yep, yep.
What about in a situation, do you lose that benefit for a mashgiach or a homeowner?
Yeah.
If you're ever on the phone and mention, okay, I'm a half hour away, I can't be there.
Right. Exactly. So in that's what I'm trying to bring out here. In other words, in such a case, for this halacha to benefit you, you can't tell the non-Jew where you are. In other words, if you say, all right, I'm on 95 in Boca Raton, and so they know that there's no way you're going to be home for another half hour. There's no chance. So if they want to go ahead and cook an egg, you know, with butter in a meat frying pan, they're not going to get caught, right? So they could do it, wash it, put it back, and they won't get caught. So if a person wants to avail themselves of this heter, it is best to not inform them where you are and what you're doing. And if you need to go out for a period of time, don't say where you're going. Don't say, I'm going, oh, I have a big meeting, you know, somewhere, and it's going to be a while. Don't say that. Just say, I'm going out for a little while. So even if you're going to be out for 3 hours, but they think that, I don't know how long the person's out for, maybe they'll come back any minute, that's enough to make a fear that maybe the person's going to come back. But here the Shulchan Aruch says clearly, if the person knows that you're gone for X amount of time, then all bets are off. Okay, so therefore, this would help for a situation for, in other words, the most common case that this would help for would be, let's say, for a woman who doesn't work, but she goes shopping or whatever, she's not going to stay home the whole day, and she has a housekeeper, but she goes out for periods of time, just the errands to take care of, whatever. So in such a situation, you know, coming back and forth could constitute yotzei v'nichnas, right? Because I keep popping in. But it only works if they don't know when you're coming back. But if you say that I have a tremendous thing to take care of now, it's going to take me a very long time, that defeats this opportunity to use yotzei v'nichnas. Okay, so that's something that would help. Now, obviously, if a couple, right, both have a set schedule in their job and they both work in far off places, or even if they work close by but they can't ever get out from their job, then that doesn't help either. Now, obviously, it doesn't help. You could work 5 minutes away, but if the housekeeper knows that you can't leave your job, you're there and you're tied up the whole day, you can't get out, so then it doesn't matter the proximity to your house, they have the security of knowing that you're not coming back. So therefore, this is something that has to be taken into consideration. But if you do have the ability to get out, then it would be beneficial to even sometimes just pop in. Just pop in. In other words, halakhically, this would be beneficial because that could make it that it's the yotzei v'nichnas. Because they don't know. In other words, even though you're tied up, okay, but I work not that far away and I have breaks. During the day, I have breaks. So during my break, I may pop home, or I could be, if I remember, I left something in my house, and I work close enough, you know, not that far away, I'll go home to get it. So that could, you have to assess, everyone has to assess the situation for themselves, but that could be enough. That could be enough to say that they're on their toes, they're nervous, because they don't know with confidence when you're ever going to show up. Yeah, yeah.
All these halakhos that talk about Kobe Kacham,
yes.
The same with the Jews there.
So that's a good question. So if it applies the same way with a Jew that doesn't, it probably should apply the same way with a Jew who doesn't care about the law.
Unfortunately, sometimes the Jews are less moderate.
It could be, yeah, that's true. That's true. But in logically, it should apply just as well to those people too. But in other words, the point is, anyone who doesn't care about the law, that's where the issue lies. Okay. So there you have the opportunity. The opportunity of Yotzei v'Nichnas. Now, interestingly enough, it's not on the sheet, but the Shach here in his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch says a Chiddush, which is a great kula, that a Yotzei v'Nichnas does not have to be an adult. A Yotzei v'Nichnas could be a child, as long as it is a child who is knowledgeable in two things. A child who is knowledgeable enough to know just the basic halacha. In other words, to know, you know, okay, this can't be done. A, and B, that could identify the kelim. In other words, if the child themselves doesn't know what's meat and what's dairy, then it doesn't help. But if they know that, and they're in and you know, they're around, so then that is a great possibility for leniency. This is the halacha that's paskin in the shach. Now this would mean that if a child is home, let's take a simple sketch, if a child is home, So that alone, if the child is, according to the consensus of the post, the child would have to be over the age of 9. But if a child over the age of 9 was home and was around, so that alone could deter the housekeeper from making, from taking any liberties because of the fact that she's going to be worried that the kid's going to see and the kid's going to tell her mother and so forth. And even if the child was Yotzev Nichnas, in other words, the child could go out also, but at unannounced times, the child, it's probably easier with a kid to have Yotzev Nichnas situation, right? On a day that they're off from school, right? So they go to a friend's house, you never know when they're going to come back, so that could be a very great window of opportunity. Okay, so that is the heter of a Yotzev Nichnas situation, which potentially could be a saving factor over here. Okay, now what happens on the other hand if you don't have that, which very often is the case where both the husband and the wife work and nobody's going to be home, and they know that nobody's going to be home. So really, this is common, and what could you possibly do to avoid the concern here? So basically, what's that?
Back to the webcam.
Go back to webcam, right? Okay, so the webcam, if you could do that, that would be a good thing. But if you can't do that, so then basically here it depends. Different rabbis have different standards here, but I think what everyone agrees upon is the following. In other words, what you would have to do is you have to set up the following system. In other words, number one, you have to, before you hire such a person, you have to sit down and explain to them the basic concepts of kashrus. You don't have to get into all the lumbus, but just explain to them, this is what we are concerned about, and you have to make it clear that we take this very seriously. And that if this is not observed, that if these laws are violated, that would be a basis for dismissal. That you could lose your job if you don't follow what we want. This is something that may make no sense to you, but to us this is very, very important. That discussion has to be had at some point. The person has to be made aware of that. You can find a discreet way to say it, a savvy way to say it, but it has to be clear to them the degree to which you take it seriously. That's number one. Number two would be that the housekeeper must be told that they cannot bring their own food. They can't bring their own food in. Bringing their own food in is a recipe for disaster, because they bring in their own food, then what do you say? Well, they'll eat it cold, but how do you know? They could, pop it into the microwave, it takes a few seconds. So you have to tell them you cannot bring in your food. Now, if you cannot bring in your own food, then what do you expect them to eat? They have to eat something, so you have to leave them food to eat. But the food you have to leave them to eat has to be something that they would be interested in eating. So you can't just take the leftovers from 3 weeks ago and say, oh, in case you get hungry, take this. They're not gonna be happy with that.
They can't eat
what's that?
They can't eat it either.
What do you mean?
Well, it's already cooked.
Right. Okay, I'm saying, in other words, you have to come up with a reasonable system. You have to come up with a system that you could rely that they have no real motivation to cook their own food. So if you allow them to bring in their own food, that's disastrous. So you have to tell them you can't bring in your own food, and here we will provide for you food every day to take. That's the second thing. The third thing is that you have to tell them they cannot cook. Even your food. Obviously you can't cook their own food, that's sure. But it's opening up a tremendous potential for problems if you allow them to cook, because of the fact that they could easily mistake meat for dairy and so forth, and they'll cook it in the wrong way. Again, without malice. They're not trying to make trouble, but they just, whatever, they're on the phone or thinking about something, and then again, to them it doesn't mean anything. So it's like trying to get a person out of their own habits. It's very difficult to get a person out of their own habits. So when in her own house, when she cooks, she just pops things into the oven. She'll look to see, oh, this is dairy and this is meat. That doesn't go into their minds. So you have to tell them you cannot cook. You cannot cook. If you cook, we can't have that. We will provide for you food, leave her a sandwich or something like that, that, or if you want to serve hot food, so then the woman of the house should be home at a certain point in the day to cook it. But to leave it for them, if you leave them, if you allow them to cook in your kitchen, you're asking for trouble. And so too, if you allow them to bring in their own food, you're asking for trouble, asking for major trouble. So therefore, that those really are the conditions under which a person could confidently feel. Even this, you should just know, if you look into the halacha, it's these things are, you know, in the old times this wasn't done. This is a lot has to do with the change in culture, because today it's unprecedented. The level to which women work in today's world is, in the history of the world, as far as we know, unprecedented. Right, as far back as in all the societies and all the cultures, the man worked, the woman stayed home. That's the way it was. It has changed dramatically in our times, and therefore that when you look in the Sfarim, when you look in the, they never dreamt of this situation. So, these are the laws that we have to go by, and the concerns are real. It's not like you say, well, it's an outdated concern. There's no concern here that you could say is outdated. This is as real as any concern in halacha you could have. Yes.
What if you have a family that has, let's say, a live-in housekeeper, and she knows on Erev Shabbos that she's cooking with you supervised?
Okay, so if you have that, which is not uncommon, that she participates in the cooking. I'm going to get to that in a minute. She participates in the cooking process. So you could make the policy that you can only cook with us around. You know, but you can never ever cook alone. You can never cook alone. And asking, and a working woman who is, you know, it's very easy to try to say, well, I'm going to get home late from work. It would help me a great deal if my trusty housekeeper could, you know, put up the food for supper tonight, you know, and all my food in the house is kosher, and there's not, you know, what are you worried about? So, okay, but, you know, there is the concern. Asking a non-Jew to cook unsupervised is taking an enormous risk. Under the best of circumstances, it has nothing to do with the quality of the person, because people make mistakes. Even the biggest Rebbetzins in the world make mistakes in their kitchen and have shilas. It comes up all the time that things happen. Nobody was trying. I made a mistake. I was talking on the phone, or I was today. People work at the level of distracted work that takes place in today's world is unprecedented. Right, you have people that sit in their offices with the things on the computer screen, or listening to the radio, or whatever it may be, talking on the phone, texting, all kinds of things that go on. So people are distracted under the best of circumstances, so that makes it much easier to make a mistake. So anyway, this is, now, everything that was said, yeah, Kevin.
You were talking about cooking, but, I mean, what about just washing dishes?
Washing dishes, the same thing.
Many people have.
Some
people have one sink.
Right. So here we have. If you look at the bottom of the page, okay, Yeridei Kufchav Bei Sif Pes, the Shulchan Aruch says, Yesh Li Zar Melehniach Bedeis Ovik Alchavim Klei Suda. The concern is not only to leave food under their care, but it's to leave kelim under their care. In fact, it's discussed here in the Ramah. You know, in the old days, before everything was disposable. So people had kitchen utensils that would break. Let's say a pot would break. You didn't just throw it out. So what did you do? You brought it to the repair shop, right? It could be even today in certain cases with commercial paint, maybe they do that. Very expensive equipment. You bring it to the repair shop. And the question is, who's the repair shop? It's a non-Jewish guy, right? So how do you know what's going on there? How do you know that they didn't use it? So you'll say, well, that wouldn't happen today. Okay, but it's questionable, you know, so, and in certain situations, you know, there's a concern that to the degree that the Ramah brings it there, if you will nothing with woman, even if you brought it to an expert worker in repairman or whatever it is, lasaknam, to fix them, you have to make some sort of simon. You have to make a sign in the pot to make sure they didn't use it. Yeah, so, getting back to the safeguards that a person can take in their kitchen, another thing which is not, I don't think, so commonly done, but is recommended, is that if a person arranges their pots in a certain order, if you know that you don't just haphazardly throw your pots into the cabinet, but you put your pots in a certain order, and you don't tell the housekeeper that, so then that would also help. In other words, if you eyeball the situation and you see, well, everything's where it's supposed to be, then in all likelihood nothing was tampered with. But if you come back and see, well, look, it looks like stuff was moved around here, so then, you know, then there's a concern that they might have taken something out and used it. These are the safeguards that a person could do. But the bottom line is that a person has to be very diligent with this because the concerns are many, and, you know, the reason for confidence is not as great as we might think. The Poskim say further that a person going on vacation, if a person is going on vacation, should not leave a non-Jewish person working in the house, in the kitchen. Okay, because there, if you're going to be away for an extended period of time, so how do you know? You know, people are very tempted. I have my trusty housekeeper. So I'm going out of town for Pesach or whatever. I'm going out of town for a vacation. And I'll have them in the house, and they'll clean up the kitchen, and they'll polish all the silver and all kinds of things. Right? But to do that is highly, highly questionable. To leave a person totally unattended. And they know that there's not a chance. You're in a foreign country. You're overseas, right? You call them from Paris. Oh, I'm having such a wonderful time. And she's also having a wonderful time cooking in the kitchen, right? So how do you know, right? How do you know that there's nothing to be concerned about? So this is as far as that goes. Okay, so whatever. Everyone has to make an assessment for themselves, their own personal situation, but it's just worthwhile to just take this to heart. That trust alone doesn't cut it in this area. Trust alone doesn't cut it. Yes, sir.
Two things. Yeah. One is you mentioned about the oath of mitzvahs.
Yes.
Another practical case, I think somebody else said, is you can also potentially use a neighbor.
Okay, right. Okay, true. Thank you. I left that out. Right. So one thing that people say, the oath of mitzvahs, again, it depends how comfortable you are with this, you can give your neighbor the key to your house. Or tell them if you have a combination lock, whatever, and ask them to every so often just to pop in. It doesn't have to be every day, but if it happens enough that the woman who works there is concerned that it might happen, that also would be open.
When you're leaving for prolonged periods of time,
yeah,
do you have to be cautious for workers that have nothing to do with the kitchen? Meaning, I have a painter who's painting
the living room. I don't know. Probably not. I would assume not, but I don't know. I don't know. If you're probably not. In other words, you have to destroy. What's that? They could use the microwave. If you're going away and you have someone doing construction in the house, it would probably be the best thing to tape up, like you do for Pesach, to tape up the oven and the microwave and stuff like that, and tape it in such a way that there's a simon, not just the way you do it for Pesach, because that's only to remind you that it's Pesach. But if you're gonna, you know, if you want to do it in a way that they can't just take off the tape and replace it, do it with some sort of scheme that I know that I put it a certain way, and if I come back and see that it's not that way, then it was tampered with. But yeah, it's true. I mean, the fact of the matter is people do take liberties nowadays. People take lots of liberties when they go into a person's house. And you know, you can't just overlook that. You can't just overlook that. You know, if you do find out that something happened, you most likely have to pass it to Caleb, right? Because you don't know. You say, well, I still don't know for sure they did it for Isser, but you have no basis to say that they did it for Heter. It's a suffix. So it could be it's a suffix d'oraisa. You know, it's a Torah law that's involved in. Okay, so I just want to address the other points that we were saying. As far as as far as the Bishul Akum. Now, the Bishul Akum is something which has really become a much bigger issue today due to the change in technology, because the basic law of Bishul Akum is, as we discussed once years ago, the basic law of Bishul Akum is that food that is cooked by a non-Jew cannot be eaten. This is a rabbinic decree. It has nothing to do with kashrus. The food, the ingredients could be 100% kosher. It doesn't matter. If it was cooked by a non-Jew, the rabbis forbade it out of the concern that it would lead to Jews and non-Jews eating together and into marriage and so forth. That's the reason for the prohibition. It has nothing to do with kashrus. Okay? So this is the law of Bishul Akum. Okay, now, there is a fundamental difference in practice between Ashkenazim and Sephardim in this area. And that is, Ashkenazim are way more lenient than Sephardim. Because in the law, in order for something to be Bishul Akum, it has to have been cooked by a non-Jew. Ashkenazic Jews hold that if a Jew participated in any step of the process, that takes it out of the law of Bishul Akum. So for example, if a Jew turned on the fire, then that would be good enough, even if the guy did everything else. In other words, as long as the Jew turned on the fire in the morning, if the guy then took the pot and put it on the fire, which is the act of Bishul in itself, that is not a problem because the Jew participates. That's what Ashkenazim hold. Sfaradim do not allow that. Sfaradim hold that it has to actually, the placement of the pot on the fire has to be done by a Jew. Okay, now, an Ashkenazic Jewry, until very recently, there was a very easy way out of the problem of Bishul Akum, because it was very common that ovens had pilot lights. So even though the stovetop is off, or the oven is off, but it's not completely off, because somewhere there's a pilot light that is on. And when you turn on the fire, it's just adding to the pilot light. So that being the case, for Ashkenazim, that alone would remove it from, as long as the pilot light was ignited by a Jew, that would remove it from Bishul Akum. Sfaradim did not ever agree with that. However, in our times, with the change improvements in technology, pilot lights don't exist anymore. It's a thing of the past. So therefore, you don't have that heter. So, because it doesn't, if you still have an old oven that has that, okay, fine. But if you don't have that, you can't get one. So what are you gonna do now? So essentially, there's no way around this. The only way around it is to, if the non-Jew is going to use things to which the law of Bishul Akum don't apply. So just to review something that we discussed once before, there are two basic types of foods to which the law of Bishul Akum does not apply. Number one, a food that could be eaten raw. A food that could be eaten raw, even if it's cooked, and even if it's better when it's cooked, but you could eat it raw, and it's normal to eat it raw, so then there's no law of Bishul Akum. So for example, a carrot, which the person could eat a carrot raw, but people cook carrots as well, so then there's no problem. That's no problem. Ne'echol chai, no problem. Same thing with water. If on a Friday, it's a common thing in a kosher home that someone has to fill up the urn for Shabbos, somebody has to put the water in, I want to have tea or coffee on Shabbos, I need the urn. It's a job. You have to pick up the thing, bring it to the sink, and fill it up. So you give the non-Jewish woman to do it, and then you say, oh my gosh, and she filled it up, she turned it on, it's Bishul Akum. The answer is that's not a problem, because water, obviously, you could drink uncooked as well. So therefore, that would not be a problem. Okay, and just for the record, commonly it is accepted by all the poskim, just about all the poskim, widely accepted, that the law of Bishul Akum does not apply to tea or coffee in general. That's how you can go into Starbucks or whatever, you go into a place and get a cup of coffee, right? So that's because of the fact that, assuming they don't have non-kosher things going on there, you could get a cup of coffee, because you'll say, what do you mean that they cooked it? So with coffee, there's no problem. The reason for that is a different discussion. With coffee and tea, there is no problem. So that you have, okay? So basically, those are certain things that are exempt from Bishul Akum. And the other category that's exempt is a type of food that is called Eino Olal Shulchan Melachim, a food that would not be served in prestigious times. The question exactly how you define that in halacha, but just to take a very easy example, popcorn, right? If a non-Jew makes popcorn, so the popcorn is not served at any state dinner or would not be served at any prestigious restaurant, right? So therefore, that type of food is considered insignificant. And since it's insignificant, so therefore you can eat, there's no problem with Bishul Akum. Those types of things, if a non-Jewish housekeeper cooked, would not be a problem, okay? If your kid needs a snack for school, and you say, throw it into the microwave, to, you know, put in a bag of microwave popcorn, that's not a problem. However, a lot of foods that we cook in our kitchen don't have either of these exemptions. So therefore, this is something that's a serious problem. If a woman goes out to work and wants to allow the non-Jew in the house to do some cooking, which, as I said earlier, is highly risky to get them into the mode that they're comfortable cooking in your kitchen, but even assuming you're going to do that, you have to turn on the light. Ashkenazic Jew would have to at least turn on the fire before going to work, and a Sephardic Jew would have to do more. A Sephardic Jew would have to actually put the food on the fire. So this is something that also in our times, you know, people like to use the convenience of having a woman in the house, and again, we say to her, I trust her. It doesn't apply in these situations. Okay, finally, when it comes to the wine, this is really a discussion in its own right, you know, what constitutes the prohibition of stam yenam, but suffice it to say that if you go out of your house constantly, it is extremely unwise to ever bring in wine that is not mevushel. Okay, we know that in the halacha, yayin mevushel, wine that is cooked, has been cooked already, is exempt from the laws of stam yenam. Wine that would be, in the halacha, wine that was unfit to be poured on the mizbeach, is which yayin mevushel is, would not be a problem. So therefore, it's very, very, very common that when you go to buy wine, the kosher wine, it says on the somewhere on the label that it's mevushel. You know, if you happen, but there are wines that are not, you have to check. If the wine is not mevushel and you have a Jew in your house, if it's a sealed bottle, it's also not a problem. But if the bottle has been opened and some of it has been taken out, then now you ask them to clean the refrigerator and they're going to take out the wine and put it on the counter, you potentially have a lot of problems on your hands. So therefore, a person who goes out of the house on a constant basis is advised very strongly not to bring in wine less than mevushel. It's not hard to go by that because much of the wine that's out there is mevushel. But here and there, you may come, you just look at the label. It's clearly marked on every bottle of wine. Okay, you just have to check for that. And assuming that that's in place, you don't have to worry. There you have it. These are the basic problems that come up with having a non-Jew in the house. As I say, it's more common today, and every person has to try to come up with a system for themselves.